Greetings, urban farmers, gardeners, and healthy food visionaries. Farmer Greg here, and welcome to the 815th episode of the Urban Farm Podcast, where every day we work together to educate and inspire you to become part of your food revolution. We have an amazing guest on today's podcast, and I'm going to encourage you to stick around till the very end when she talks about her online course on permaculture and space design. I think you'll really like it. Today on our podcast, we have someone who helps people design food forests and gardens with a holistic approach. We're talking with Corrine Irby about resilient homesteads. Corrine is the owner of Broken Ground and a garden design consultant and educator. For over a decade, she has helped people in cold climates grow their own food so they can eat healthier, live more sustainably, and become more self-reliant. From getting clients started on their first ever garden to working with couples on designing a full-blown homestead, plus designing large-scale farms, she's helped thousands of people grow nutritious food for their family through consultations, design services, her signature Resilient Homestead program, and her YouTube channel. Corrine and her husband live on a suburban homestead in Bozeman, Montana, with their dog Benny, a greenhouse, pond, vegetable gardens, a food forest of fruit trees and berry bushes, and a flock of chickens. Welcome to the show today, Corrine. Are you ready to rock?
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. So I just shared a bit about you. Can you fill in the blanks for us and share more about the path you took to get where you're at today?
Yes, for sure. Thanks so much for having me on your podcast, Greg. So I like to often start by acknowledging and looking back at my ancestors, where my grandma, actually on my dad's side, kept a journal from 1943 to 1956. And she had a garden. And they had a milk cow for a while. They had chickens. And she wrote in her diary almost every single day. And my dad found these diaries when they were going through her stuff. And he had those years transcribed, and he gifted them to me, my sister, and my cousins.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
wow.
It's quite a gift. And I think I look back on that, and one, she had six kids and she had this garden. And so her diary entries are canned 12 quarts of tomatoes, made butter, made ice cream, picked the beans, planted the pansies. And she was in a cold climate like I am, but in central Minnesota, so somewhat different. And so it's such a gift to see her through that process, and punctuated by, that was during World War II, so it was punctuated by these historical facts. But what's interesting about that is that I didn't learn how to garden from my grandmother or from my mother, who had a garden up until I was 5 years old. And I think that a lot of us have that history in our background, a history of gardening or farming in families.
Mm-hmm.
But I came to gardening and growing food through a much more circuitous route. And I was, from a young age, I loved animals. I loved the natural world. And I went into environmental science, but then got deeply involved in social justice and human rights issues in Latin America. Spent some time in Guatemala.
Wow.
And began to look at and see the impact of the global food economy on some of the poorest people in the world. And I came back from that experience as an idealistic 20-something, wanting to change the world, but always in this negative space where sometimes activism is, where you're always against someone or something, or telling people everything that we've done wrong. And at a certain point, I burned out of that whole way of being, and I began to look for solutions, and took this class that was taught by Dr. Vandana Shiva and Satish Kumar in India, called Gandhi and Globalization. And it was, how can we apply Gandhi's philosophy to what is happening right now with this global economy and economic globalization that's impoverishing people in
And you actually went to India?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so 2 weeks on Vandana Shiva's organic farm. And so that was a big moment for me, just in terms of understanding the diversity of seeds that exist and the diversity of different grains and plants and everything that we've lost since then with our industrial food system. And that was the first time I heard the term permaculture.
Ah, the P word.
Yes, the big P word. And so that's when I started getting more involved in that and realizing that permaculture provided a way through. It was focused on positive solutions, was focused on what we as human beings could be doing to regenerate the earth, to grow our own food, to relocalize our economies. And I really got excited about that concept and took a permaculture design course, had my own
Nice.
garden for some years, and then did some advanced training and then opened
So
a business.
you took your permaculture design course in an interesting place. I took mine in my own backyard. You didn't. Tell us about that.
So I ended up going to New Zealand to take a course there. And one of the reasons was I was in a transition in my life, late 20s, early 30s. I basically quit my job, quit my relationship, moved, and wanted to do something different. And I was born in Australia and had not been back. I spent 2 weeks there as a baby and had never been back. And so partly I wanted to go back to that part of the world just to explore it and to see it. And it just so happened that there was this design course in New Zealand. So I took that design course in New Zealand, and then I worked on organic farms through the Willing Workers on Organic Farms organization. I worked on organic farms both in New Zealand and Australia, and that's how I saw that part of the world.
Nice. And your permaculture design course or PDC was in New Zealand, but who was a teacher? That's even more magical.
Yeah, Jeff Lawton was one of the teachers, and then I did
Wow.
my advanced training with him on a 10-week permaculture internship in Australia a
Oh
few
my
years
gosh.
later.
Wow.
So before he was super popular, he was still popular back then, but now I think he's gotten even more and more
Yeah.
visible,
Impactful.
impactful. Yes, is a great way to put it.
Yeah, cool. So I love to ask permaculture designers to define permaculture.
I know. I have two definitions. I have it's a design approach to sustainable living and land use that's rooted in the observation of natural systems.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's easy, simple.
Looking at natural systems and mimicking them and the way that we design our yards, our gardens, our neighborhoods, and our communities. That's one way of looking at it. The other definition I love, which is the art of creating beneficial relationships. And I can't take the credit for it. I think it was Starhawk that came up with that definition. But creating beneficial relationships between plants and animals, between plants, animals, and people, and also creating beneficial relationships between people. I like that definition too, because it reminds us that permaculture is way beyond organic gardening. Most people come to it through that, but it's way beyond that. And it's an invitation to engage in the broader philosophy of permaculture.
I like to call it permaculture the art and science of working with nature.
I love it.
Just boil it down really simple. And the thing about permaculture is pretty much everybody that does a permaculture design course, which is a 72-hour deep dive into an introduction of permaculture, has their own definition. And I highly encourage y'all out there to jump in and do a permaculture design course, and because it will change your life forever.
I think that so many people come to permaculture like I did when they're in a time of transition. They're seeking more meaning, they're seeking something different to do in their lives. And that's why it's so transformative and gives you a different way of looking at the world. And I think especially for Western culture, where people are so disconnected from their roots, from any kind of tangible culture, it really takes off for people because it is a way of knowing and of being that gives them an anchor to live by.
So I have to ask, Bozeman, Montana, is a long way from New Zealand. How'd that happen?
I know, right? Love. I had been living in Denver, and then I met my husband doing these cross-cultural community service programs. We were based in Peru, but he and his son were living in Bozeman, Montana. So he brought me up here. He likes to say that he saved me from the big city. And it is beautiful. I'm very thankful that he brought me away from the big city and into a place that was perfect. A lot of people didn't know about permaculture at the time when I moved here, and I wanted friends who were gardeners and plant nerds and liked permaculture. So I started doing talks at the library about permaculture and hosting film nights and created a
Cool.
community here. But yeah, growing in a cold climate is not the easiest task. But this valley, in fact, is is historically an agricultural area. So in that sense, it's the perfect place for me to be.
Nice. Well, so I moved to Asheville 2 years ago, actually, this week. Phoenix was a hard place to get people to think about growing their own food. And I worked on that for 40 years in Phoenix, and I moved here. And there's this organization called ASAP. It's the Appalachian Sustainable Food Systems Organization that formed 22 years ago when the tobacco industry was crashing.
Wow.
Yeah, and a nonprofit, and the organization has hundreds of members. And it sounds to me like Bozeman's going through some kind of a transition like that now as well.
Yeah, as one of the fastest growing micropolitan cities, I think people are a lot of our agricultural land is being taken up by development. So people are really thinking about how can we conserve agricultural land? How can we support new farmers, which is really hard when land access and land is just so expensive here?
Yeah,
And how
everywhere.
can we build a robust food system?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you're starting to plug in to that, with the city's doing some great work in that arena.
They're starting to look at the Bozeman Climate Plan and looking at food as part of that. I often find that food systems and agriculture is left out of the climate change conversation, oftentimes, in terms of
Right.
what we can do. And so they're looking at how to bolster the local food system here in our community through either kind of supporting community gardens, through maybe having some sort of local food council, maybe doing some kind of community center. We're very far from a lot of those initiatives, but at least the conversation is happening because I think there are just so many people in the valley that have an agricultural background. And because growing food is historically part of this valley, they're concerned about the development that's happening and how we can maybe change the trajectory.
Ooh, the seeds have been planted.
Exactly. Yes. And I view my business as part of that in terms of can we retrofit the suburbs and get more people growing their own food in the suburbs? If these developments are happening on some of the best agricultural land, then let's rethink, reimagine what that looks like. Maybe it's not these larger farms, but it's backyard gardeners trying to bolster their food resilience.
And that's where you come in, I think.
Yes.
Okay, so what tell me about your company, Broken Ground, and what you do.
Yeah, so I, like you said in the introduction, I teach people how to grow their own food. I do workshops for people, so do education and run different programs. I do consultations with clients where I do site visits and talk with them about where to put what and what they want to do. And I do edible garden designs for clients. And I work both with clients here locally and then also some clients remotely. And then I do my signature Resilient Homestead program where I take people through. It's a 4-month program that happens from November through February, where I take people through the skeleton of the permaculture design course, the basics of permaculture design, permaculture ethics and principles, soil building, creating food forests, capturing water. But in the process, I'm also taking them through, I'm guiding them through their site plan. So I take them through the site planning process. And what I've found is that a lot of my clients are DIY, so they want to learn
Yeah.
more and they want to participate in the design of their landscape. And so I just act as a guide and a mentor of and give them some sideboards. Because I think what happens, and I've had many clients now over 10 years of doing this, where they have a vision for their property, but they have no site plan on paper. And so it's this very nebulous, vague thing. And so this program creates some sort of structure and accountability to actually get something down on paper, to actually think through what their vision is for their property, and gives them a timeline for implementation. That's maybe 3 years or 5 years or however many years, depending on the scale and the scope of their project.
Yeah, and it also depends on their level of energy to be able to do it. I do online consultations or virtual consultations with people, and I did one with a couple in Phoenix this last week. They have four kids, three kids and another one on the way, and they just moved into a house and it's bare dirt in Mesa, Arizona. And through the course of the conversation, I step by step walked them through, here's the plan, and it might take you 3, 5, 7 years to do it. And that's exactly what they were after. So it sounds to me like you're doing something similar with your Resilient Homestead program. And now, is this an in-person program or a virtual program?
It's virtual. We meet on Zoom every 2 weeks from November through February. And what I find is good is that it's mostly people in cold climates that come to me and to sign up for the program. So winter is a great time for dreaming and planning. Okay? Whereas spring and summer, everyone's in action. So, that's why I have that course when I do, is so that people can go inward and think about what they want to create, think about their vision, and then be ready to go in the spring. And like you said, I think people are surprised when I say your implementation plan is anywhere from 3 to 7 to 10 years. And I think people don't realize that, oh, something like that can take that long because they're used to these instant kind of ornamental landscapes that you have, right, in the suburbs, and that it gives them a good idea of, oh, this is an evolution, right? My landscape is dynamic and I'm participating in it. And I might have small kids right now, so I have less time. And as they grow older, they can help in the garden. And so that implementation timeline might get shorter, but really working with clients to make them understand, to give themselves a little grace for one, to underscore that they need to be patient with natural systems as well, and they need to be patient with themselves in the process.
Exactly. And that was part of, for this consult that I did with this couple the other day, that was their thing. They were overwhelmed. They were stepping into this amazing backyard that was bare dirt with a couple of trees, and they were jumping from that to, I want fruit trees and food and gardens and like that. And it doesn't happen overnight. I've learned that again, because the last place I moved from in Phoenix, I was there for 32 years. And all of the infrastructure, all of the old growth food forest, it was all in place. And then I moved here, and I have told people this for years, and I had to finally take my own advice. Spend at least a year on a property before you make any major changes. Because if we would have put in the chicken coop or the greenhouse or the gardens when we first arrived 2 years ago, they would have been in the wrong place. That's where the patient comes in at.
Absolutely. And I think it's hard. I recommend the same. And it's hard for people because they're so excited about it. But I think that's where most of my clients come to me, and that it is, they're overwhelmed and they don't know where to start.
Yeah.
And I think that's where our guidance is so critical. I always regret going to a client site and they've put in all of this stuff. And I think in the back of my head, gosh, I wish you would have called me about a year ago before you did all of this, right? Because I don't want you to redo some of your stuff. But if this was more of a blank slate, we'd probably put some things in different locations.
Yeah, I had a guy recently that I was working with, And he had just spent $6,000 or $8,000 on raised bed block planters in the desert with a western exposure. So that
Right.
means they got sun from noon to sundown. And I did my best. I didn't call him out on it, but I did my best to coach him on, all right, how can we minimize the heat on the space? And it's just things people don't think about.
And I think that's why I love my job so much, as well as like the invitation for people is to remind them where they are, situate them in their place, and be like, this is a place that has limited water, so we want to take these strategies. This is a place that where these native plants do really well. And I think that's that whole, yes, I have what I do in my job or in my business, but like fundamentally, it's trying to reconnect people with the natural world
Yeah.
and having them observe and be in a in the, their place to know, yeah, actually, a super green lawn doesn't make that much sense in this climate. So maybe we want to minimize that on your property. And these are the plants that do well. And no, we can't do sweet cherries here, but we can do sour cherries and some pears. Just getting people connected in that way to what works. And
Yeah.
why can we not do these things and not other things? Because of the average minimum winter temperature, just like small steps in terms of education.
And in place is, that's a big word and a small word. The small word is your place is your space that you bought. My urban farm in Phoenix was 80 feet by 160 feet deep. And then there's the place of the neighborhood, which I used to walk around and observe. Even after spending 30 years, 25 years at the urban farm, I would walk the neighborhoods and observe to see what was working in other places near mine. And then there's the place of, so Phoenix is a drylands. So when I did my permaculture design course, it was a drylands permaculture course. And I'm sure you teach cold climate permaculture, which is different than drylands permaculture.
And I think that's why the framework of permaculture is so powerful. In the sector analysis that you do, it encourages to, okay, who are your neighbors? Okay, what's the prevailing wind? Okay, how much rainfall do you get? Where does the water flow? So it's a framework to engage with your place. I think there are people that inherently do that. For a lot of us, we don't, because so many people are transplanted from different areas and don't necessarily know a place. And that's we I've had a family cabin in our family for over 40 years, and we've been going there every summer for over 40 years, and I know that place because there's something like you were on your property for 32 years, right? You know that place. And I think it's really encouraging people to get to know a place and to walk, to hike and do all that to get to know that, and also to get to know the social context that you're
Yeah.
in. Here we're a big farming and ranching community and a hunting community, right? So there are certain things that work and certain things that don't work. And you have to be aware of that context to be successful here.
My basic premise of permaculture, and I suspect a lot of people's is observation. Pay attention. Spend at least a year on a property before you make any changes. Watch where the water flows like that.
Absolutely.
So when you work with somebody, how does that work?
One of my favorite ways is through the Resilient Homestead Program and or one-on-one consultation packages. And I start typically with a client questionnaire, asking them what their goals are, what they want to grow, have them craft a statement of purpose about their site. You know, what's their vision for their site, their overall vision for their site. And then some of get into more of the nuts and bolts of what kind of budget do you have? You know, what who else can help you? What do all the people on this property and on this site do? So get them thinking about the networks of support that that might help them along the way. So I do that first, and then we have a meeting either on site or remotely, depending on if they're in Bozeman or not, where we talk back through that whole process. And then we go through the kind of site map, coming up with a base map of the property, doing what in permaculture is called a zone and sector analysis, right? What we talked about before, prevailing winds and sun and storm sectors. Is there wildlife,
Utilities.
utilities, noise, pollution, views, getting them to consider all of that. And then it's that whole kind of bubble diagramming it out to see where things could go, getting an idea of what they want on their property, listing all of that, all what in permaculture are called elements, whether that's a food forest or a fire pit or a patio or a tool shed, and then putting it all together in terms of a design. So for sometimes I'm just a guide and a mentor and having them do the work, and sometimes I'm doing that work. So it just depends.
I'll bet you've seen some really exciting results. I'm sure you've had something that along the way that happened. I love asking this question. Something happened, and you thought to yourself, oh my gosh, this is the reason I'm doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think that happens quite often when people will send me a text with a photo of what they just put in, right?
Right?
Or last year, I had a client who wanted me to come have lunch in her garden because she wanted to thank me for the part that I played in making this haven for her kids and herself. And she was brought to tears. She's like, I'm so glad you came out, and I just wanted to thank you so much because this has been such a gift for me and my kids. Wow. Again, that whole, there's a lot of things in this world to be really get depressed and down about, but it's all of these small steps that all of my clients are taking in their backyards and on their sites that gives me hope and that gives me that inner resilience to continue, because those aren't things that you'll hear about in the news, but people are just doing that every day. And I think in the garden, especially, you see the results much more quickly. And in the garden, people feel agency. They feel like they have the power to change something, right? They can take a lawn and turn it into a food forest, or they can take a lawn and turn it into a pollinator garden. They can do that with their own hands. And I think that's where I love inspiring people to do that. The other day, I got a text, and it was a student of mine who'd taken my Resilient Homestead program, and she showed me all of her family got involved in planting fruit trees.
Oh,
And she
nice.
showed me pictures of it, right? So she and her three kids and husband, they all put in these nine fruit trees. And I had been to her site the week before, and we flagged out where all of those were going. And it's again, not only do we know that putting in that fruit tree is going to give them fruit in perpetuity, but we also see the benefit of having their whole family contribute
Involved, yeah.
and what kind of impact that has. So it's, there's all those intangible benefits to that experience. And again, that's resilience building on so many
Yeah.
different levels.
On so many different levels, that's for sure. I have a question here that you sent over. What are the five top lessons you've learned after being on your site for over a decade?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So many lessons. I know the top five is hard sometimes, but
All right, go three.
yeah, I
Or is
know.
that
Well, no, the
harder?
top, I think the top five is hard because there's like about 50 lessons, but I think one of them is the observation piece. Like you said, I didn't take a year. I didn't follow the, because you don't, you get all excited. That's why I encourage my clients to take a year, because I didn't. Just like you said, you would have put things in different places. And one of the biggest things actually is if I'd taken the year, then I would have met my neighbor earlier, because we moved in December and Bozeman, it's winter time. People aren't outside, and we have one adjacent neighbor, and I would have put a gate to her yard. Because why? Because she helps me with my chickens, and in me having chickens encouraged her to have chickens. And so we do an exchange, and we also do an exchange. We talk over the fence, right? I hand her tomato plants, she hands me back
Isn't that
carrots.
nice? Yeah.
And so that's one of the lessons that I would have learned.
That's a
Second left, yeah.
I want to jump in here though.
Because I had a neighbor at the urban farm in Phoenix when I was there, and we wish we would have had a gate because of that. There's so much value in that.
Yes. And that's that social systems piece that I talk about with my clients and with my students, that we don't, it doesn't have the same level of importance that we put to, okay, where is that apple tree going to go?
Yeah,
And yet it's more
exactly.
important.
Yeah.
Right? And I always tell my students, like, agriculture was never meant to be a solitary act. Historically, it was done in communities.
Yep.
Here we are toiling away individually in our yards and gardens, trying to grow this food for ourselves, and then we wonder why we're exhausted and or we can't get it all done, right? Because you weren't supposed to do it alone,
Right.
right? Like, when I look back at my grandma's diary, what's clear to me is she's doing some of that alone, but then her neighbors come over, and then she's going over to her neighbors and helping. And there's even back then in the 40s, there was more of a communal feel to what was happening to food growing. Whereas now, it's everyone has their individual, all of the things that they have to do. So I think encouraging that social connection, Wendell Berry said the soil is the great connector. Well, the garden is the great connector as well, right?
Well,
That
when you have a party, where do people congregate? In the
exactly.
kitchen, around food.
Yeah. So it's just that whole people creating community around food. I think we have to remind people that's how it used to be, and that's how we as humans are our best selves in many ways, right?
Yeah.
And it's the easiest way through which to build community. I
Yeah.
feel like a lot of people sometimes come to Bozeman, they're like, oh, it's really hard to feel a sense of community. I'm like, not if you get involved in the local food system here, in my opinion. And that's a privilege, and that's, but it does seem that social systems design and building that into your property is fundamental to the success of your site. So that's one of, that's my first lesson. We went on this little tangent and journey, but
I saw three or four things there, but go ahead.
yeah. I think my second lesson is to get on the voles sooner than later in terms of pests, right?
Oh, yes.
And figuring out how to deal with the voles, of course, as putting in fruit trees and berry bushes and a food forest with wood chip and mulch and dead plant material everywhere is a great habitat for these voles, which are small little rodents. And
Yep.
I just kept on hoping that they would just go away. And so
They
that's,
don't.
they don't. And having to deal with that and the dance and the relationship of what to do there has been a big lesson. And then my final one would be, I think I probably would have put the trees farther apart. That's a pretty simple one and a mistake, but I think I would have planted things a little farther apart, and that's something that I recommend with
Yeah.
clients, especially in a cold climate, having that open canopy and having plenty of sun.
Yeah.
But I think it's hard sometimes with bare root plants. You get them and they're so small, and you don't imagine that
Get big.
they're going to get big. And that's where the importance of a site plan comes into play. And that's, again, one of the reasons that I encourage clients to work with me is don't make the same mistakes I did. I've made a lot of those mistakes.
Right? Yeah.
Gardening is like constantly about failure. And so I've been through that process. And let me give you some tips on what not to do.
Yay. So where do people find you?
At brokengroundpermaculture.com is my website. You can also follow me at Broken Ground MT on Instagram, and my YouTube channel is at Broken Ground. Those are the three main ways to get in touch.
Cool. Awesome. So I'm going to shift on you, and I'd like for you to talk about a time you failed, how you overcame that failure, and what you learned from it.
I was thinking about this question, and I think, like I just said, in a garden, you fail all the time. I often tell my clients, if you don't have failures every year, you're just not trying hard enough as a gardener.
Exactly.
And encouraging people to fail because people don't like to fail, especially as adults.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's been definitely a teacher for me in terms of just every year having something not work. I think I go back to last year, we had a massive snow year and we had snow on the ground for 6 months straight. That's no exaggeration. And it was very high. And some of my shrubs were covered in snow. And again, getting back to the my le one of my lessons about not dealing with voles earlier, they had eaten my Nanking cherries. They had eaten all of the bark off of all of the branches. And so I lost these growth. They were about 5 or 6 feet high. I lost the growth of those Nanking cherries, that probably 5 to 6 years worth of growth, and had to cut them back. And I think there are a few lessons, I think, as a gardener. One, that ecosystems are dynamic, right? That things happen, that pests and disease move in and out. And so it was a great lesson in just letting go and in realizing, okay, that was like 5 years of growth. And this is what happens. You have an epic snow year, which is great for our snowpack and for our water. Wonderful. But that happens. But I found that after I pruned them back, oh, they actually could have used that prune, right? That they came back. It didn't take them long to come back. And now they actually look a lot better. And so there's partly that too, that there's maybe a gift there. But I think that mostly with all of these failures in the garden, like early on when I was a more inexperienced gardener, I would get really frustrated and angry, or just beat myself up a little bit, like, oh, you should have known better. And now I'm just like, okay, that there's this longer game that you're playing, and that it's not just about that one growing season, and to be okay with doing things imperfectly. And I think that just in general is part of our invitation, right? Is that when we talk about what's going on in the world and people don't know what to do and they're a bit paralyzed by what they can do. And I think we need to encourage people just do, we don't need everybody to do this perfectly. We need the most people to do this imperfectly, however and whatever that looks like. That so whether that's like 1,000 square foot garden or this big, huge food forest, or whether that's two cherry tomatoes in pots and a couple herbs that you grow, like just do something, participate in some way in the natural world and in bringing a little bit of food to your table. Like I don't need you, I don't need, we don't have time for purists, right? We just need to all be doing something and contributing in some way.
And your biggest success?
Think it's creating community. Yeah, one
Yeah, I
of
can get
the
that.
biggest missions in my business has been to reweave a web of connection between people through growing food and through meeting. So I talked about, I did film nights before, I did talks, I do potlucks as part of my business. So every month, we're having one next Tuesday. Every month, I hold a potluck. And sometimes it's on client site, sometimes it's on my site, sometimes during the winter time it's just at a community center. And it's just any clients, students, anyone from the community that wants to come and share a meal. And during that meal I do what's called an offers and asks. So if you have something that you can give the group, that you have to give to the group, whether it's like irises or mint or even something unrelated to gardening, you put it out to the group, and if you need something from the group, you ask, whether that's compost or topsoil or a plumber. And so the whole idea there is one, to connect people, and two, to remind people that not every interaction has to be monetary, to get back to the barter system of doing things. And I, people love those potlucks. And I think that's been a great way whenever I hear about people who met and have then continued a friendship beyond that, that also gives me a lot of hope of, oh, I was responsible for creating a place, a container through which these individuals connected with one another, and then now they're connected in our community.
Wow. How cool is that? Congratulations.
Yeah. It's a small success, but I feel like it's an important one.
Yeah, I disagree with you. I think that's a huge success.
Yeah.
So just saying. And what drives you?
The natural world. Like, I think the non-human species in this world, whether mm-hmm. they're plant or animal, I think that's definitely where I come. That's my why. Yeah. Is the incredible biodiversity that we have on this planet and what we're losing. And I've always been an animal lover and read Diane Fossey and Jane Goodall when I was in my teens. Mm-hmm. And I think it's still that. It's still having these beautiful places that I don't need to visit, but I just need to know are out there with these amazing creatures that are part of this bigger web of why we're even able to live on this planet. Yeah.
I have been on this track in my life since I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a paper on how we were overfishing the oceans in the eighth grade at the age of 14 in 1975. I have no idea where that came from. And I have a sense that the way we're living on the planet is problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And I carry it as a weight.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to see what's going on the planet. And Heidi and I are having that, Heidi's my partner, and I are having that conversation last night. And she said, Greg, what gives you hope?
Mm-hmm.
And I sat with that for maybe a half an hour. And we were watching a TV show that was related to all this. And it said something about nature. And it sparked in me, wow, yes, nature is what gives me hope.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it sounds to me like that's what you just said.
Yeah, I think it gives me hope and it makes me sad at the same time. Oh. And I think that's what gives me hope is our ability to our human to change things, mm-hmm. to create habitat, to create ecosystems, right?
Yeah.
Like in planting a food forest, you're the architect of a mini ecosystem where all sorts of birds and insects are coming in and benefiting from it. And I think it is, yeah, when you are feeling down and you go out in the garden, you got like bumblebee that's going to town on something that you've planted. Or the last year I had a hummingbird that would perch in the plum tree because she had a nest nearby, right?
Aww.
And every year she's coming back and doing that, right? That gives you hope, right? Oh yeah, I was the architect of this ecosystem and I've created this habitat for this bird.
Beautiful.
To come in.
Yeah.
It's hard. I'm not surprised that you sat with that for a while because it is something that weighs on a lot of people. But I do feel hopeful when I gather with community. And I think that what's happening is that a lot of people are isolated right mm-hmm. now. And because they're hopeless, they're numbing out in all of the ways that we have that are totally understandable. And what we have to remind people to do is to gather in community
mm-hmm.
In order to be more hopeful. You go to a potluck, you talk to people about what they're going to be planting in their garden. That's hopeful, right?
Yeah.
Or you've just had this very nourishing meal from people's gardens, right? The collective meal that people have brought from their mm-hmm. gardens. That's hopeful. Going and volunteering at a site. I have volunteers that come help me every week, right? They come to learn, yes,
mm-hmm.
but they also come to be around like-minded people and just to chat and to
yeah.
have a sense of community. You know, those are all hopeful small moments that cumulatively make a difference, I think, in people's lives.
Yeah.
And when you're hopeful, you are in action more.
Amen to that. And if you could recommend one book for our listeners, what would it be and why?
Oh, this is a really great book. I love it. It's called Healing Grounds Climate Justice and the Deep Roots of Regenerative Farming. And
Ooh.
it's by Liz Carlisle. And she's also written the book, The Lentil Underground. But this book in particular looks at stories of Indigenous, Latino, Asian, and African American people who are reconnecting with their ancestral roots of farming, roots that have, because of the industrial food system, been suppressed to a degree. And the whole book is a reckoning around this country's history of agriculture. And it's beautiful because, of course, now regenerative agriculture is very visible, but it's important. It's an important reminder that these land use management strategies are thousands of years old often. And that's where it gets back to those roots. That's why I like to acknowledge my ancestors, is to understand where you come from. A tree is more resilient and thrives better the deeper its roots and the broader its roots. And as people, the more we understand where we came from and what our ancestry is, the more resilient humans we are. So it's like reconnecting people to the natural world, reconnecting the people to their ancestry, reconnecting people to who they are. And that's one of the reasons why I like that book.
So nice.
I would recommend.
Nice. Thank you. And what one final piece of advice do you have for our listeners?
I think it gets back, I would say, create community around growing food in what, however that looks to you, whether that's hosting people in your garden and having a beautiful meal, whether that's holding a potluck or whether that's having people come and volunteer in your garden, just do some little bit to reconnect people with one another and with their gardens.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for joining us on the show today, Corinne.
Thank you so much, Greg, for having me. Really appreciate it.
You bet. So how can our listeners get a hold of you?
Yeah, so through my website, which is brokengroundpermaculture.com, also on Instagram at brokengroundmt, and on YouTube at brokenground.
Great. And just give us a 2-minute on your course that you give in the fall.
Yeah, so the Resilient Homestead Program is a 4-month online course where I give you the nuts and bolts of permaculture design while at the same time taking you through a site planning process. So at the end of our 4 months together, you'll have a site plan on paper, you'll have a timeline for implementation, and then you'll also have kind of the knowledge and tools to implement your site plan come the spring.
Which is an amazing piece of data to have in your hands.
Yes.
Just have to say, having studied permaculture for 32 years, that is like the keystone for your success right there.
Absolutely. Yes. It gives you a roadmap to get you started and to really create the vision of your property that you want.
Awesome. Again, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And you can find show notes from today's podcast at urbanfarm.org/brokenground.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Urban Farm Podcast. Remember to listen for tips, advice, and resources to help you on your journey with urban farming. You can find us on the web at urbanfarm.org or send us an email to podcast@urbanfarm.org. In the words of Vincent Van Gogh, great things are done by a series of small things brought together. Be encouraged that with each lesson learned and skill developed, you are one step closer in the direction of your dreams.